This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being here with us today. And we begin today along the southern border. Back in Washington, D.C., Congress is voting on a big spending deal today. But left out of that deal again is immigration, border security, and what to do about the nearly 700,000 undocumented young people avoiding deportation with the DACA program. Along the border, meanwhile, in southern Arizona, there is talk of a wall today and a history of tension.
Third time. Oh. We're getting harassed.
Yep.
No, you're not.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
Everybody goes through.
No, we are getting harassed.
May I say hi to everybody that's in the vehicle?
No, we're U.S. citizens.
I'd like to be able to confirm that.
He just saw that we're U.S. citizens.
We're just like you guys. We just don't have a green uniform.
So we're trying to do our job.
What you're hearing there is a confrontation between Tucson priest and U.S. citizen Abron Tadeo and a Border Patrol agent back in December of 2016. Tadeo was crossing back into the United States from Mexico with six relatives, including his 77-year-old mother, and ended up getting arrested.
Sir, step over here.
I'm going to open the door.
You're not going to open the door. What you're going to do is you're going to step over here, okay?
Don't touch me.
I'm going to arrest.
No. What the heck are you touching me for? Stop. I did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong.
Tadeo was charged with assault after that incident. Those charges were dropped just this past December. Hundreds of thousands of people cross the U.S.-Mexico border every day without incident. But what you just heard is one example of encounters that can take place between U.S. agents and people crossing a border with Mexico that stretches nearly 2,000 miles. The U.S. Border Patrol apprehended 341,000 people along that border in 2017. Now, that's a 44% drop from the year before. But while the number of migrant crossings has dropped, the number of deaths increased in the past year from 398 to 412. So today we want to go behind some of those statistics and get a sense of what life and encounters actually look like at the border. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a former Border Patrol agent who wrote about his experiences on the job. But first, a reporter whose beat is the border. Michelle Marisco is the senior editor on the Fronteras desk for KJZZ in Phoenix.
The legal traffic, which is people who live on both sides of the border, people who work on both sides of the border, a massive shipping industry, and that tallies up to several tens of thousands of legal crossing through ports of entry every single day. Between those ports of entry is an entirely different matter. There we have undocumented immigrants, and those numbers have been dropping, but they continue to try to cross the border illegally.
Well, Michelle, illegal crossings are down, apprehensions are down, but the overall number of migrants who've died making the journey hasn't dropped.
Yeah.
What's going on?
We still have about 1 to 2 people on average who die every single day trying to cross the border illegally.
Michelle, you visited a morgue in Arizona near the border that keeps the bodies of undocumented people, if they die, while making the journey across the border.
So we're here in the cooler. You can see that the remains to the right-hand side of the cooler in these white body bags are generally our undocumented border crosser remains. And since it's a small bag, it clearly doesn't contain an entire set of human remains and is likely skeletal remains.
This is Dr. Greg Hess. He is the Pima County Medical Examiner. His forensics team has done some incredible revolutionary work when it comes to DNA examination on bodies of people who are found out in the desert. So many of these bodies, like he describes, there are skeletal remains. They've been scavenged, and it's been a long time since that person was alive. Sometimes these numbers become politicized, you know, the number of people who die on the border. Some federal agencies like to try to keep that number down by saying, well, if we can't identify who that is, then we can't say it was an immigrant. Dr. Hess's office has been revolutionary in circling back on that argument and identifying that these people were indeed immigrants.
Meanwhile, Michelle, let's talk about the wall before we run. What's that debate like in Arizona? And when you go to the border there, what changes do you see in terms of anything new being built between Arizona and Mexico?
So, yeah, let's talk about the border wall. Here we already have two types of border infrastructure. We have what we call vehicle barriers. These are these X-shaped steel beam structures that exist for about a third of the Arizona's border with Mexico. And then we have these bollard-style walls, which are bars, essentially almost like a jail cell. right? And these exist in the urban areas around Nogales, Arizona, around south of Yuma, Arizona, and some of these other places. Between the two, roughly 70% or so of Arizona's border already has some sort of infrastructure. Most of this came about as a result of the bipartisan Secure Fence Act of 2006. Many miles of infrastructure were added as a result of that rule. Now what's being talked about is replacing a lot of that new infrastructure with, of course, these concrete and steel, massive 30-foot high walls that are being tested out in San Diego.
And if you're a voter in Arizona, Michelle, your support for the wall, does it generally break down along the lines of whether you support President Trump or not?
Yes, absolutely. If people support the president's policies when it comes to immigration, then yes, the wall is very much in favor for some of these voters. People who are looking at the administration's efforts with immigration as something that's far more heavy-handed than we are accustomed to as a country, then yes, the wall makes no sense. Logistically, law enforcement officials here that are not the U.S. Border Patrol or not Homeland Security will tell you that the wall is going to have a minimal impact.
Michelle Marisco, senior editor on the Fronteras desk for KJZZ in Phoenix. Michelle, a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The story of the southern U.S. border with Mexico was an everyday reality for Francisco Cantu. He grew up near the border, studied it in college, and then after school, joined the Border Patrol and returned as an agent to experience what life was like there firsthand.
I remember talking with this woman. Her husband was kind of watching us, and he saw that we had a connection. I remember him turning to me and saying, "Hey, man, you know, can you just bring us back to the border? Just be a brother." And in that moment, I was like, no, this is my job. I can't do that. And it wasn't difficult for me to say that. And, you know, so I took him back to the station. I remember, you know, wishing them luck and like introducing myself to them and telling them my name and asking them for their name and then sort of sending them on their way and telling them to be safe. And then what still sticks with me about that interaction is that, you know, even like an hour after that, I remember sitting in my car and not being able to remember their names. And I think that, like, that's the first stage of dehumanization. I wouldn't have realized it at the time, but looking back on it, that was me normalizing violence and becoming numb.
I spoke with Francisco Cantu about his experiences as a Border Patrol agent. He writes about them in his new book, The Line Becomes a River. It's out this month.
I grew up in the Southwest. And then I went away to college. I kind of became obsessed with immigration and border issues. And so by the time I graduated, I knew that I wanted to come back to the Southwest. And I had like all of these questions about the border from all of this academic learning and, you know, a lot of the same questions that we're sort of grappling with today. And so, you know, I saw the Border Patrol as a way to, you know, get answers. And I also saw it as a way to, you know, get a sense for the border as a landscape and as, you know, a wild place. And so I was really, you know, looking to have an understanding of what the border feels like and what the sort of realities are day in and day out. And I didn't want to just be there on the weekend. I didn't just want to go there for day trip. I wanted to sort of understand what this place was like on, you know, the hottest day of the summer and the coldest night of the winter. And that's really what led me to join.
Well, talk a little bit about the job while you were in it, the kinds of people you called colleagues, and really the day-to-day work, what it was really like on a Wednesday at 2 o'clock.
You know, one thing that a lot of people might not realize about the Border Patrol is that it's really like 80 to 90% kind of tedious boredom out in the middle of nowhere in the desert. You know, you're literally looking at dirt. You're watching the fence rust. But the other 10% of the time is, you know, really unpredictable, really dynamic, possibly dangerous. But, you know, more than any of that, more than the drug busts or like car chases or any of that sort of exciting sounding stuff, what really stuck with me, the biggest impressions that I carry with me now, looking back on it, were these sort of quiet human interactions that I had, you know, with the people that were crossing the border that I, you know, was bringing into the station. The thing that was impactful about those interactions was the way that they made a lot of these platitudes that you hear about the border very specific. So for example, you know, one of these things that we always hear about the border is like, oh, you know, there's good guys and there's bad guys. And you know, the good guys are just coming here looking for work. And you hear that so much that it's just this refrain that kind of means nothing. But, you know, I'll never forget bringing someone into the station, you know, apprehending him as part of a group. I remember putting his fingerprints into the computer and processing him for deportation. And, you know, he kind of looked around the room and sort of asked me, you know, while I'm waiting here, is there anything I can do? Can I take out the trash? Can I clean the cells? And I thought, you know, you don't understand. You just have to wait here. A bus is going to come, going to take you to the next place. And he says, no, I understand. I want to show you that I'm here to work. You know, having someone say that to you, standing right in front of you, I think it changes things. It makes it personal. And you know, nothing is more powerful than an individual story.
And it's individual stories that humanize others for us. And in reading your book, it's one of the main things you seem to have taken away from this experience, not viewing immigration or border security as kind of an abstract policy concept, but face-to-face with migrants, with people who want to work or are fleeing trouble back home or something like that.
I mean, what I think about when I hear our conversations about immigration and the border, it's impossible for me not to think of like all the glaring things that seem to be missing from that conversation. You know, there's this urge to simplify the border, to talk about it in these black and white terms, to say, oh, build a wall. When I think about the border, like I remember the people that I interacted with. And, you know, one thing that I'll never forget is like finding a dead body in the desert and, you know, being face to face with the two people that had accompanied this man on his journey, you know, these like young boys who are now just wondering what to do with the body of like their uncle. The fact that there are people dying out in the desert, that's not being talked about to the extent that I think we need to be talking about it. I mean, I think that's a humanitarian crisis, and it's one that's happening on our own soil. We're not acknowledging that in our conversation right now about border enforcement or immigration reform. And I think, you know, we have to move towards acknowledging those people, acknowledging their deaths, mourning their deaths, you know, naming their bodies. So many of these people are unidentified. And I think, you know, in general, looking at these numbers and these statistics as each being, you know, representative of an individual person.
There's a section in your book, Francisco, where you write, what you do as a border agent depends on what kind of agent you want to become. But it's true that we slash their bottles and drain the water into the dry earth. We dump their backpacks out. We step over them. You say, this is the kind of thing that Americans have recently seen in viral videos on social media, border agents slashing water bottles, pouring the water out. You say it also gave you nightmares afterward.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even if you as a Border Patrol agent don't participate in that, you know, I never participated in that, it doesn't absolve you of it, right? Because you're part of this larger structure. You know, I'm still sort of very preoccupied with to what extent we can separate the individual from the institution that they work for. I think that, you know, we have this policy that has really weaponized the landscape, right? We're pushing crossers away from the cities, away from these areas that are more regularly patrolled into the most dangerous, rugged, inhospitable parts of our desert. And people are dying there. And we can't lose sight of that. So these humanitarian groups that are leaving water in the desert, you know, they're working to fill a deadly void that has been left open by our policy. I think that to criminalize that aid or to destroy that aid is totally unacceptable. I think that the Border Patrol needs to be held accountable for that. And I also think that while we must hold individuals accountable, we also can't lose focus on the larger structures that are at work and the institutions that put that person there, that trained and equipped them for their job.
Well, the president gave the State of the Union address, Francisco. He talked a lot about immigration. There are policy proposals on the table. People will debate those. But you also saw the message from the president. It goes back to the campaign. The subtext of that message seemed to be that undocumented immigrants are a threat to your safety if you're an American. These people are here to harm you. Here's an example of somebody whose child tragically was killed by an undocumented gang member. Sort of distilling a lot of immigration down to that. And I wonder how you digest that kind of messaging in this debate.
I think we're constantly being made to look at and talk about migrants in ways that are dehumanizing. And, you know, personally, I think that we should reject thinking and language that facilitates exclusion. I think we should resist labeling migrants as the other, no matter what kind of other that is. You know, labeling someone's existence as illegal, or, you know, conflating every border crosser with gang members. To regard like an entire person as somehow being unlawful, I think that sets us on the path towards intolerance. And so I'm as concerned about it as a lot of your listeners are, I'm sure.
Why did you finally leave?
Shortly after I started working for the Border Patrol, I would start to have these dreams or nightmares. And, you know, in the everyday course of my job, I think I had been conditioned to think of what I was doing as normal. I think I normalized a lot of the violent aspects of my job. But in these dreams, you know, I would come up on dead bodies, or people I had arrested and sent back would, you know, come back to me. I even had dreams where I was like chasing people and shooting them down. For years, I just ignored those dreams, but they didn't go away. I would also have these dreams that my teeth were falling out. And I remember going into a dental appointment like years after I had joined the Border Patrol, and the dentist, you know, told me that you grind your teeth in your sleep. Your teeth look terrible. And I was like, I've never had that problem before. What are you talking about? He said that I had, you know, worn through the enamel on my molars. And so that was like the first time that I was sort of confronted with a physical, real world manifestation of this, you know, creeping subconscious horror that I had, I think, been feeling about the job and that had been building up about the job. And so that was really the moment when I had to sort of sit up and look at myself and say, you know, something's wrong here. Something's not right with me.
It wasn't just in your dreams, though, Francisco, because you write that your mother thought that the Border Patrol was an oppressive type of agency. You reassured her. You told her that you wouldn't forget where you were from, that you grew up bussing dishes with migrants in restaurants near the border, and that you wouldn't lose sight of that. In the end, did that work out the way you promised?
Well, I think there was a lot of naivete behind that argument that that I made to my mother. And, you know, after joining the Border Patrol, you know, my mother was always there kind of holding me accountable, reminding me of those reasons I had given to her, right? Reminding me of who I was before I joined the Border Patrol, and asking me, you know, have you lost sight of that person? You know, looking back on it, you know, those dreams and my mother, those were sort of the only tether that I had to who I was before the patrol, or to who I was outside of the Border Patrol. So I'm not entirely sure that, you know, without my mother, that I would have come back from that in the same way.
Where do you think this debate is headed in America? I know you watched the big speeches and the debates. You spent some years of your life on the ground, on the border, where immigration is a real part of life. Where do you think this goes in America?
I guess what I would say to that is that I hear these words like, you know, we have to show empathy to the people that are crossing the border. We have to have compassion for, you know, people like the Dreamers. And I've been thinking a lot about that lately, because I think that we often sort of pat ourselves on the back just for feeling empathy or compassion for someone. And then we sort of feel like that's enough, like our work is done, like we're a good person. But especially with regard to migrants, you know, with people who risk their lives on a daily basis to cross our border, or who are here and are living in constant fear of deportation. I don't think that empathy or compassion really goes far enough. So, you know, I've become interested in what comes next. You know, how do we move beyond empathy and compassion, and how do we translate that into action?
The book is The Line Becomes a River, a memoir of a Border Patrol agent along the southern border of the United States. Francisco Cantu is the author. It's been great to have you.
Thank you so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.